Well, the great thing about this new technology called Zoom, which we've been using quite frequently over the last couple of weeks, is we can have visual contact with our contributors. And so, for the first time, actually since December, although he's been a regular weekly correspondent, obviously with a slight gap, due to obviously the reasons of the pandemic, we can welcome Richard Fitzwilliams. Richard, it is good to see you, he says, on a radio mode.
Quite literally, you mean, and likewise.
Looking good. Now, the one thing, as I think I said somewhat mischievously, admittedly, I think when we spoke last Saturday, was we can tell that things are getting back to normal because first thing that comes through from the point of view of the Meghan and Harry scenario is Meghan starts effectively saying, or her people, should we say, start effectively saying, they've raised over £1 billion, they're doing this, they're doing that, etc. The palace hung her out to dry and so on. If you add that, obviously, to the shenanigans, obviously not connected, of Ms. Maxwell and Kevin Spacey and Prince Andrew and so on, the royal family, the firm, shall we say, still has a number of challenges to get through as the year proceeds.
Yes, it's an interesting scenario, isn't it? Because last year was a very bad year for the royals. Then, what is the purpose of a royal family? The main purpose is symbolic of national unity above party politics. And in the period of the pandemic, of course, which we're still going through, but nonetheless, one might hope. Very, very sincerely hope the worst was over. What I think we have seen is that the Queen, for example, with those broadcasts and the way other royals have been handling matters, I think that is an example of how they've done extremely well. Obviously, with government advice and guidelines, and obviously the fact the Queen was actually able to look back when she spoke to the nation in that way is very significant. But yes, you're right. Andrew and issues linked to him, anything linked to him, and we've got daily doses of it now, or it seems like it, is a festering sore. There's no question it's a very serious problem. And Harry and Meghan, there are difficulties there too. I think that's obvious. I would firstly just say that again, yet again, to see that photograph, supposedly taken in 2001, there is Andrew, there is Virginia Roberts as she was then. He's got his arm round her. And there's Ghislaine Maxwell, who has just been arrested by the FBI. Now, no one has ever satisfactorily explained that photograph, and it remains damaging. We saw that about 3 days ago, and now we've seen another photograph of Ghislaine Maxwell and Kevin Spacey larking around in the throne room at Buckingham Palace, sitting on the thrones. This was apparently, this was linked to Andrew because Spacey was a guest of former American President Bill Clinton, and Ghislaine Maxwell, of course, as we all know, is a very close friend of Andrew's. They were touring Buckingham Palace, and this is a disgracefully undignified behavior. But of course, the whole problem is the impression all this gives. And the facts are that Andrew's legal team and the FBI are at daggers drawn, and that has been obvious. Jeffrey Berman, the prosecutor, has been replaced by Audrey Strauss, but the rhetoric is exactly the same. They say Andrew hasn't cooperated. This is the FBI. I'm referring, of course, to the FBI inquiry after Epstein, the child molester's death, to help the victims, but also to establish who was culpable, who was helping Epstein. And regarding this, Andrew's offered cooperation. His legal team say he's offered it several times. The Americans say it's a lie and he hasn't. It would appear in this case that they're referring to the desire, it would seem, of Andrew to give written evidence, and the desire, apparently, of the Americans to have an interview. Now, there was a curious thing that's happened, and that was that there was a report by the BBC that a mutual legal assistance request had been filed by the FBI. Now, Boris Johnson, when asked about this, appeared to dispute that it had been received, and yet it again is in the papers, reported as having been made. And that could mean that Andrew, in some form, is asked to give evidence under oath in a British court. And it's also significant that Sir Keir Starmer, Labour leader, has weighed in and said that Andrew must cooperate. That's in today's paper. The whole thing becomes a saga that has been of distress and embarrassment to the royal family ever since Andrew's absolutely grotesque interview last November with Emily Matthews at Buckingham Palace. But there were a variety of other issues. In fact, his charitable foundation had closed down because of a payment to his, apparently one of the trustees, who was his former secretary, Amanda Wright, who was behind organising the interview. This was a period over some years, it's been alleged, but his pictured palace has gone. He still kept his military links, and I think he has some ideas he might, in some form, resume royal duties. And I don't think anybody does. And I think that the fact he had to step down in disgrace is one thing. The fact that this is he not offering evidence? I mean, this has to be solved one way or the other very soon. The other thing, as you mentioned, Harry and Meghan. Meghan's case, we don't know when it's going to be heard, against the Mail on Sunday for publishing extracts from a letter she wrote to her father, Thomas Markle, which he then revealed and which were published. This is going to be possibly a cause célèbre. I mean, if Thomas Markle appeared in the witness stand, either personally or virtually, whenever it's heard, and also Meghan's friends, who wrote a piece in the magazine People, which involved a quote from the letter. Meghan's legal team say that she was unaware that this was being written, and that it was in fact to put her side, because there was such an overwhelming amount of negative publicity about it. It has to be stated that the initial skirmish between the lawyers on both sides, the Mail on Sunday and Meghan's, was rather curious, because several claims of Meghan's legal team were thrown out by the judge. It was just an initial skirmish, and they may come back. But the very odd claims they're making, that she was hung out to dry, as you mentioned, when she was pregnant, that the palace press office didn't respond to so many accusations. Indeed, there were 250,000 articles about her, and they would have been absolutely impossible. Of course, they have no comment.
It's all very emotive language, and one's left with the thinking that maybe this could actually provide some useful material for David Starkey, if he actually chooses to write more on the monarchy and so on. I just roll that out there, because he possibly could do with some rehabilitation himself recently.
David Starkey is someone who is beyond the pale at the moment. There's no doubt about that. It's just unbelievable. He was known as the rudest man in England, but I mean, this is plain insanity. So far as the Meghan.
So who better then to actually relate to the royals and Prince Andrew in the present time? You see where I'm going here. It could be a nice sort of combination factor.
I most sincerely hope that it won't be, but what I do think we're going to get is, what we're seeing actually is the fact that Meghan's legal team, from what I've seen, don't seem to have much understanding of how the monarchy works. And I say that because, firstly, the no comment rule is par for the course when it comes to almost every article, has to be. Secondly, there is a sort of comparison.
But they are Americans, Richard. Let's face it. There could be a reason for that.
Well, there's no reason when you're dealing with the British court, something that is very unwise to begin with. If it's going to end up in any form of court appearance, the last senior royal to appear in court, of course, Meghan isn't a senior royal now, but you're looking at someone with a very high profile, and there was Edward VII when Prince of Wales in 1891 and the great backer scandal. Queen Victoria was horrified. That was his second appearance. There'd been one earlier in a divorce case. The facts here simply have to be stressed. Meghan's legal team were brought in Princesses Eugenie and Beatrice and Prince Michael of Kent as an example, were what appeared to be an example of royals who earn money for their living. But since they're not working royals, of course they do. It wasn't relevant to the case. So what I'm saying is I don't think that from what I've seen so far, the pieces that have been in the papers, anything could happen, of course, and we don't know when the case is going to be heard, but I don't think there is an understanding amongst her legal team of how the royal family works. And it's very curious that Harry, who must have had some dealings, well, seen some of it, has allowed this to go ahead, because either that or Meghan herself, when she was a royal, were a senior working royal,
didn't last too long, did it, really, overall? I mean, it was a matter of months, really. I saw it. Anne of a Thousand Days was even longer.
It was absolutely extraordinary and very, very sad from that point of view. You see Meghan give a talk on Black Lives Matter to her the graduates of her school. You see what a wonderful, the articulate person she is and how committed. The point is, however, not only did the royals lose a lot, but also it seems that she certainly didn't fit into the way the royal family functioned.
Richard, we'll put this out to her now through the system. As you know, these podcasts go global. They're available in every sense of the word, as long as you've got a computer system. If Meghan and Harry would like to join us for one of these little chats, I'm sure we'd be more than happy to welcome them on board. So there we are. I'm just putting it out there. Richard, it's been wonderful to prove that this connection actually does work and function effectively. So we got there in the end. We'll hopefully be resuming with a slightly greater number when we start talking about the future of British cinema post-COVID in the very near future. But I need to ask you those last two questions. They become standard with a slight variation. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
I certainly have.
So I take it then we can connect again via this magical mechanism in the very near future.
We certainly can.
Slowly but surely, we're bringing together Midweek Drivettes across the years, across the ages, across the generations, and of course one of our finest, and indeed voiceover artists, who we regularly hear interspersing the interviews and doing all manner of wonderful things, whether it's announcing Filled In as from Los Angeles, whether it's a case of doing the prep for Annette Andre, etc. It's clearly the one and only, as we said, voiceover artist, horse racing commentator, actor, general all-round fine soul, who is Malcolm Tomlinson. Yay, Malcolm!
Hey, Alex, good to be back.
Yeah, well, now we kind of, I mean, what really drove me to this Zoom thing was primarily the fact that, well, if all those journalists could actually handle it with respect to our Prime Minister, then it shouldn't be beyond our wit and engagement to actually use the whole thing and connect with it accordingly. So why not, indeed, use the technology and entertain the listener? That's what we're about.
Absolutely, Alex. There's one or two little blips on the politicians' behalf, hasn't there, with technology, which has caused us a little bit of amusement. So,
Yeah. But then again, I think actually in these times, better to be socially distant than to actually run the risk of spreading another spike in the virus.
Oh, we couldn't agree more, Alex. Absolutely. Yeah.
And now, from your own point of view, I mentioned horse racing commentator. You were one of the first, quite literally, out of the blocks in terms of sports, albeit behind closed doors, obviously. And you were up in Newcastle doing commentating, what was it, back end of May or early June?
It was early June, actually, Alex. Yeah, it felt a little bit like Dunkirk and D-Day, sort of last one off the beach, you know, Cheltenham Festival and all that malarkey. And then first one back, yes, 2nd of June was my first day, but the actual racing industry kicked off again on the 1st of June, obviously behind closed doors. And I have to say, it's very, very stringent. You know, the quite rightly, you know, the procedure you have to go through to access the course itself, you know, we're all have our temperatures taken. We had to complete a COVID questionnaire, and we have to do that every single time we attend a race meeting. So it is still very strict, and masks worn and all that sort of thing. So yeah, we're doing it properly, which is good.
Yeah, no, exactly. Now, were you at Cheltenham? Were you actually there?
No, I wasn't actually. I was working for the Cheltenham radio, but right. I wasn't actually at the venue. So
socially distanced, you see. You were ahead of the game once again, you know. It's ahead of that curve system. And, you know, as we've said, obviously horse racing has brought a lot of joy to a lot of people. We recently had Royal Ascot. Never quite sure whether it should have had the prefix Royal, because surely for it to be Royal Ascot, the Royals have to physically be there. I don't know. It's just a...
Well, I think the thing is, Alex, the Queen and the Royal Family actually own the Ascot estate. So when you see them on a normal meeting, a normal royal meeting, leave Windsor Castle through the great gates, they actually drive straight out the gates of Windsor Castle onto the racecourse, because that is their land. They own it. So in other words, they own that meeting, and they had to give their permission for that meeting to go ahead. So I think that's why we're still called the Royal Meeting, Royal Ascot.
You know, that has set my mind at ease, because I've been debating that with newly qualified veterinary surgeon people, Zoe Jameson from Northern Ireland, Richard Fitzwilliams. But yes, so it's basically a case of, do you fancy a bit of racing in the garden today? Okay, let's go with it. Okay.
You've got it, Alex. You've got it. Spot on.
Any surprises in Frankie Dettori still actually pulling out winners and obviously the results that we saw there?
Not really. I mean, he's just
nearly our age, isn't he, really, Frankie Dettori? He's moving through the whole system before too long. He'll be in his 90s.
Well,
I'm suggesting we're in our 90s, but you never know.
Absolutely. But, you know, Lester Piat kept cracking on, didn't he, until late into his 50s and, you know, riding winners at the Breeders' Cup. So there's no reason Frankie shouldn't do that. He's still right at the top of his game, and he's a great ambassador for the sport as well. So, A, it wasn't a surprise to see him do so well at Royal Ascot, and B, I think he pretty much deserves what comes his way. Is that good?
Now, good news from the point of view of the government recently in terms of, and the arts industry, because obviously wearing your other hat, non-race horse racing commentator, clearly big input, and we recently received, I think, from a couple of folk that you've worked with and we both worked with in times past, from Beverly, Neil King, and I think that his company are basically saying we need to support this campaign. Hopefully that injection of cash and finance might just keep a number of theatres afloat that otherwise would probably have gone undone. I'm thinking about the new Theatre Royal Lincoln. I'm thinking about probably the whole new Theatre Royal. All of those aspects are there.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more, Alex. And of course, this whole track. And of course, you know, in my little town here, the East Riding Theatre in Beverley, which only launched in 2014. But I've done a few professional shows there, and it's a fantastic little venue. And I know they could do with a little bit of help, because they've managed to save a little bit of money through, and all they do is finance and sells through ticket sales. So tremendous credit to them that they put on successful shows, and they've saved a bit of money, but I know they're really struggling, and that, you know, if they don't get part of this 1.7 billion, whatever it is, then they are going to go under. So, you know, hopefully it will reach little outlets like that, which are so crucial for the community. You know, it's just marvelous to have that sort of professional theatre on your doorstep, and it's really well supported because of that.
The key thing, of course, is, are we kind of doing this interview setting the scene for what is going to be the modus operandi for years to come, or is it a case of, well, we will get back to some socially distanced viewing of things and so on? I think either way, our generation, and probably the younger generation as well, there will be a scar, an emotional scar that's possibly been left with this. Because you mentioned the Dunkirk spirit. Yeah, on the one hand, you can compare it. But on the other hand, we haven't had the bombs. We haven't had the destruction. We have had this very pernicious virus and viral plague, which has impacted very much on our kind of social aspects. And I think we've also seen recently how the sort of bounce back carries with it huge risks, whether you're in Melbourne, whether you're in New York, Washington, London or Liverpool. It's still really too uncertain because nobody really quite knows.
No, I think that's it, Alex. And I think in terms of people attending live theatre performance, I'm a little bit confused, as a few people are, how it's appropriate to attend a cinema performance but not to attend a live theatre performance. But I'm leaving that aside. I think people will only really start to feel comfortable attending live theatre and live concerts once a virus is in place. Once a vaccine is in place. Yeah. And, you know, that could still be several months away. I mean, personally, I think it's probably going to be into next year. Having said that, I know that theatres are very keen to try and you know, get Panto revenue in or Christmas show revenue in, because that is a big part of the revenue that they rely on throughout the course of the year. It's probably their biggest show of the year. So if they can start to get bums on seats for Christmas, all well and good. But there's going to be an awful lot of people who are reluctant to a normal theatre goers who would be reluctant to attend, simply because, as you say, it's just a complete unknown still.
And not that I wish to be a doom monger or indeed a naysayer, but we're both young enough to remember in the 1980s the huge furore and challenges that were put forward by the AIDS virus, and there still is no vaccine available for that 40-odd years later. There's only been various lines to help cure the whole thing. So hence the reason, and I think in that case, yes, people did modify behaviour, change, adjust, etc. You're aware of that. But this is something that's, I would say, arguably even on a different scale because of the impact it's actually had.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, you know, in the actual AIDS crisis, it was devastating, you know, particularly for the gay community. And, there was a school of thought that thought to a certain degree, you know, regulating behaviour, then it became avoidable. Whereas...
Or if you're now, a hemophiliac...
We are regulating behaviour now, but it's still not necessarily totally avoidable. I think that's the difference.
But, you know, positivity, that's what we've shone through. That's the whole line that's there. I still remember your several guest lectures to our students at the University of what used to be Lincolnshire and Humberside, now the University of Lincoln. We said, visualise your awards, visualise the sort of golden work that you're putting together. And actually, one cannot underestimate that. We'll be speaking later on today with one of our wonderful gurus in Florida, again, having their own challenges, Mike Dooley. Mike, very much a proponent of thoughts becoming things. You need to choose the good ones and you need to actually focus on that. So it's a cliche to say it, but you cannot underestimate the importance of a positive mental attitude.
Yeah, I still believe that's so true, Alex. You know, I think the argument for positive thinking is extremely, extremely strong. I think it always will be extremely strong. I notice mindfulness is really taking off these days as well, and you know, that whole welfare of the inner soul and the inner body and the inner mind, and that's very useful as well. And you know, in projecting a positive way forward for yourself, it's crucial, I think.
Now, I need to ask the question, Malcolm. During lockdown, did you actually treat yourself to a series of box sets of all of Eleanor Tomlinson's fabulous work? Because, I mean, there's sufficient there to actually, you know, she's built up a good body now. I would have thought you could have spent a good week actually watching, you know, everything from the onset of her Angus Thongs days through to obviously Poldark, through to the wonderment of War of the Worlds, plus lots of motion pictures thrown in as well, and so on. So you could have actually just sort of had wall-to-wall, this is my daughter. Yeah, it's all good.
Well, actually, Alex, there's a yes and no answer to that question. Mm. I did watch quite a few, but Eleanor was with me for quite a bit of lockdown, and she refused to watch quite a lot of it.
but she should surely, it could have been like a watch-along. She could have actually been quoting lines from the thing itself, really, you know?
Yeah. She's not that keen on watching herself on the screen, and actually, to be honest, I think most actors have sometimes got an issue with that, so I can understand it, but... she was subjected to watch a few things.
Very good.
You know, the funny thing about you know, all the big things she's done since Angus back when she was 15. Mm. I'll just tell you this story very quickly. She came home one day and she said, "Will you meet me at Beverly Station, Dad?" And I said, "Yeah, absolutely, no problem." And it was late at night. Hull Fair was on. Now this is when she's, you know, maybe third or fourth season of Poldark. So everybody's talking about Poldark. It was this massive show. So Eleanor...
Imelda! Eleanor, Demelza, sorry. I'm getting my Demelzas and now.
Close, Alex, close. Yeah. The train doors open and a whole gaggle of young teenagers fall onto the platform. The train's so crowded. Eleanor's right in the middle of them and they're all bouncing up and down saying, it's jazz from Angus Thongs, it's jazz, you know, and they're wanting a photo with jazz. So, you know, it just shows you how popular that little film was. You know, yeah, a lot of the younger ones still want to know for that, really.
Well, moving on back to horse racing, what does your schedule have for the foreseeable future? Is it a case of, well, I'm going to be adding to that carbon footprint and scooting off all over the country? What the hey?
Well, to be honest, Alex, the powers that be, in their wisdom, are keeping us commentators as local as we
there
can.
We apologize. You're already being booked.
That'll be them phoning me. Now, don't worry,
yes,
the answer.
Yes, it's fine.
We'll pick that up in a minute.
Exactly.
I'll wait for it to stop ringing, and then I will speak again. Stop. Thank you.
Voice control telephony. I'm very impressed, Malcolm. Rush straight in there.
So, yeah, the British Horse Racing Authority are keeping as local as they can. So I'm doing a lot of Beverleys. Beverley are racing behind closed doors. I was at Thirsk last night up in North Yorkshire. I've done a red car and I've done a couple of Newcastles. And I've also been sent up to Scotland a couple of times, simply because I'm one of the most northern-based of the commentators. There's only 19 of us, and three of us are based up north.
You're probably Nicola Sturgeon approved, then. We can actually say Malcolm Tomlinson, an NS Nicola Sturgeon approved commentator.
Well, I think I might well be, because I had to go up to Hamilton Park last week. And of course, Nicola hasn't yet opened Scottish hotels. So everyone's saying you're going to have to drive up there and drive back on the day, Malcolm, which is about 8 hours in the car, which in itself is ridiculously dangerous. But Nicola Sturgeon gave permission for the hotel to open on the track at Hamilton Park, so that the key workers, I use the way it's phrased very loosely, could stay in the hotel.
I don't know, Malcolm, when we were clapping on a Thursday, I was thinking of your good self. I thought, you know, let's clap for the key racehorse and commentators. Very good. You know,
I refer to key workers in the horse racing industry, not, of course, our brilliant National Health Service.
We could go on, and we probably will, actually, but time, as ever, sort of begins to move on. I've got two final questions to put to you, variations on the theme, as we said. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
I've adored the Zoomer. It's been great, Alex, and I'm glad to know that I'm capable of Zooming.
Yes, because actually this is, I've only been Zooming, so to speak, for the last 2 to 3 weeks, actually. So I'm gradually getting a sort of notion of this, as I've pointed out beforehand, when people say, but how do you read the room when you've got lots of faces staring at you and you're coordinating that? I say, well, we're in radio. We're used to speaking to nobody if they switch themselves off. It's par for the course. Only kidding. But in terms of that, can we then prevail upon you to join us again, possibly with a couple of others, and maybe we'll actually sort of resume Zooming for the Midweek Drive in the near future?
I would be more than happy to do that, Alex. I shall look forward to it, in fact.